This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Join us for a journey as we go back to the great civilizations of the past. Who were the people? What were they like? How did they begin and how did they end? Let's find out on episode 49, Kashta, King of Kush. Previously on The Fan of History, Egypt is weak and divided. Israel has a golden age. The Assyrian Empire is falling apart. Dan, what can we glean from all this terrible and positive information? Seems like there's so many ups and downs.
Yeah, we're in the 750s BC now, and a lot of great things are coming in the next few episodes. So much is going to happen. But the king of the week is Sarduri II, the king of Urartu. Urartu is the strongest state in the Near East. And I don't even know if Assyria is a close second anymore. The Neo-Assyrian Empire is in a super bad shape.
Incredible.
Yeah. Sarduri II is the seventh king of Urartu. Urartu is roughly proto-Armenia, so it's in the mountains. It has one of its strongest kings ever, and Assyria has its weakest king ever. The Assyrian royal army is what keeps the Assyrian empire together, and it's led by Shamshi Ilu, the Tutanu, the field marshal.
Right.
The troops are still in good shape. On the field of battle, Assyria will beat anyone, including Urartu, if they can get their act together and bring the army somewhere. But Urartu is hiding behind fortresses and mountains, and they are assembling allies, particularly in Syria, to take on Assyria once and for all and take out the empire. It's been running for 160 years, and if you ask Urartu, the Assyrian Empire should come to an end very soon.
Right. Okay. So So what makes him so confident that this is going to come to an end so soon?
Well, the empire is collapsing under its own weight. And in 759 BC, Assyria has a revolt again.
Oh, great. Another.
Yes, and this revolt is only stopped because of another plague that sweeps the land.
Wow, did they describe this one any more detail than the last, or did they just say a plague?
I think it's the same civil war that started in the last episode and still goes on, but we don't have any details. And the king, Ashur-dan III of Assyria, he is doing nothing. We don't know what he's doing, but he, I don't think he has much power. He's controlled by nobles, and the nobles are struggling with each other for power over their provinces.
Sure.
And so Assyria is in chaos pretty much until 755 BC. And we don't really know what happens to Assyria in 758 to 756. But the Urartians, they are on a roll, everything is going good, and they believe that now with help they could take out the empire, perhaps in the 740s. So they are building their power structures, and they want the empire gone, because if the Assyrians were not immediately to the south of Urartu, then Urartu could really reach its potential without having to fear the top-notch Assyrian army every day. So in overall I have very little news from 758 to 756, but in 757 there is a change in Athens. The office of Archon, is that how you say it in English?
Office of
the Archon.
Yeah, Archon. That's how I would say it.
Yes, this is the ruler, the way Athens is ruled at this time. And there's a change to that office in 757 BC. It's reduced to 10 years from something bigger than 10 years. And the first one to get this new Archon office is a guy called Charops.
Charops?
Yes. And there is some sort of crisis in Attica. Attica is the area where Athens is. And up to this point, you have Attic pottery reaching other areas of Greece. But now there is a sharp archaeological decline of Attic pottery. And you also find very few Oriental objects in Attica. And the influence of Attica seems to diminish in the 750s BC. And Athens is clearly falling behind the other city-states, because Greece is growing. Greece is getting more powerful, but not Athens. And Athens wasn't very powerful to begin with after the Bronze Age collapse. It did survive, but it was reduced to almost nothing. So bad times for Athens too.
That is so much bad to go around in these times.
Yeah, but there are other places where things are better, but we'll get to them. But first we have to talk about Ashur-dan III again, because in 755 BC, this really bad king of Assyria dies. And you would think that when a weak, inefficient ruler dies, that's good news. But this makes everything a lot worse.
Oh, no.
So in 755 BC, Ashur-nirari V takes up residence in the throne room in Kala. And it is possible that his power doesn't extend outside the palace at all. But he is pretty much a prisoner in the palace. And not allowed to make any decisions at all. Because he is even weaker than Ashur-dan III.
Wow.
It is also unclear if he's the son or the brother of the late king, Ashur-dan III. It has now been 27 years since Adad-nirari III died. So it is possible that Ashur-nirari V is a younger son of the last decent king of Assyria, Adad-nirari III. But now, the Neo-Assyrian Empire is totally controlled by nobles. And among them, of course, Shamshi-Ilu being the most powerful. But Shamshi-Ilu is also getting old now. He's been around in our story for 50 years, taking more and more power every year. There is a battle in 754 BC between Urartu and Assyria. Okay. At least if you ask Sarduri II of Urartu.
Okay.
Because he mentions a victory against Assyria. And the Assyrians, they don't mention anything at all. They say, oh, nothing happened this year. But Saduri says that he had a brush with the army of Ashur-nirari V in the district of Armi or Urmi, and this is possibly in Shubria, which is a border region. Okay. There is a city called Inkeria that was captured by the Urartians. And this seems like, wow, the Urartians are capturing a city from the Assyrians. But these places are, I haven't been able to find them. I don't know where this is. It seems to be a border area, but I have no idea where this is. So if anyone knows, let me know. So it's once again like Urartian names.
Right. Point it out on a map for us.
Please do. But there's this great pincer movement going into the west and possibly even into the east around Assyria from the north, from Urartu. So when the Urartians finally decide to destroy the empire, they can attack from three directions into the Assyrian heartland. So Assyria is, from what it looks like here, this should be the end of the Neo-Assyrian Empire. In the 740s, possibly.
Wow, okay.
In 754 BC, Kala, the Assyrian capital, gets a new governor. We don't really know which year this happened, but this is my educated guess. It's a guy called Pulu. So he is a governor of the capital of the Assyrian Empire. So he's possibly in a very good position to control the king or oppress the king. He might also be the younger brother of the king. At least he will claim that he is. But we haven't really seen any kingly brothers do important stuff in the Neo-Assyrian Empire before.
Right. I was just trying to think. I was like, I don't remember any kind of brother situation happening here.
It's actually a big question. What happened to the earlier Assyrian king brothers? Because an Assyrian king could have hundreds of children. And we never get a mention of someone being the brother of the king.
Right.
Until now. We will get brothers of kings later, but I can't remember anyone before this. But this guy becomes the governor of Kala. Pulu, governor of Kala. Remember that. In 754 BC, a guy called Polydorus becomes one of the kings of Sparta. This is a very contested date. He could become the king in 741 BC also. But we'll put him here in 754 BC. And he's a member of the Agyad dynasty. They have two kings in Sparta. So there are two dynasties going around at the same time.
Okay.
That's the updates from the Near East. But now we have to go to Egypt.
Egypt, oh boy.
And for once, we'll not try to avoid Egypt.
Yeah, because from the heights of power to, wow.
To something we'd rather not talk about. Yes. It's been like that for 100 years now. But the situation in Egypt is that there are several pharaohs, at least four independent rulers in Egypt. Shoshenq V is the 22nd dynasty pharaoh. He's of Libyan descent. He's probably ruling from Tanis in the north, in the delta, close to the Mediterranean. But his power over Egypt is contested. So Egypt has been dawdling around in splendid isolation since the Sea Peoples, since the fall of the New Kingdom. But the Dark Ages are now over and Egypt has fallen behind the rest of the world. And soon Egypt will be invaded from all directions.
Well, but now rich, fertile land, ripe for the picking. There off yes. The Nile.
And the southerners that will invade Egypt, they will make an effort to become the Egyptians. But the northerners that will invade Egypt, they have only one god, and that god is not an Egyptian.
Dun,
but
dun,
now
dun.
We will focus on the southerners. Because to the south of Egypt is a land called Kush or Nubia.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been around forever. The Egyptians mention Kush already in the Old Kingdom. That's almost 2,000 years before this. But during the New Kingdom, the Egyptians conquered Kush and built their temples in Kush. But when the new kingdom fell, Kush became independent, but these monuments, the Temple of Amun, etc., they were still there. It is quite unclear what happened in Kush at this time, and I will go with the Cambridge Ancient History version. That's okay. What I do all the time. Cambridge Ancient History is my Bible for ancient history. So we have this kingdom. It is probable that the kingdom wasn't united after the fall of the new kingdom. So Kush was divided. But when Kush now enters our story, it's a unified country. It has its center of power in a place called Napata. Napata! It's between the fourth and the third cataracts of the Nile. So you divide the Nile depending on places where you can't pass with boats. That's a cataract.
Right.
And reaching the highest numbered cataract was like the goal of the new kingdom. But between the third and the fourth cataract, you have the capital of Kush now. And Napata is clearly named in the days of the new kingdom. So this is an Egyptian name. It marked the southern limit of real pharaonic control during the new kingdom. It may or may not be identified with Gebel Barkal, where temples dedicated to the Theban god Amun were built in the 19th and the 18th dynasties. And this is a debated point among scholars. But so Napata could be located somewhat differently from Gebel Barkal. And how much the presence of these Egyptian temples influenced the Kushites is a big question. But okay, let's talk about Napata, the capital of Kush. We can't really reconstruct the history of Napata or even of Kush from the late 20th dynasty. There is no archaeological evidence in Napata before 850 BC, after the fall of the New Kingdom. So that's a period of 300 years when we don't really know what was going on here. We know that there was a Kushite attack on Egypt in the 950s. We talked about that on the podcast. But we didn't really know anything about it. And there is really no evidence for a united Kush kingdom. I think I talked about the kingdom of Kush when we did the centennial overview of nations. But there is really no evidence before 850 BC that there is a unified country of Kush. You often hear that the cult of Amun is the god of Thebes, one of the most important gods in Egypt, and that the cult was maintained in Gebel Barkal, in Kush, during all this time, that there were priests, the temple was in operation. But that's probably just a fairy tale. But it's also a contested question. But now there is worship of Amun in Napata, so the Kushites are worshipping Amun. And this could be a marketing device. This could be a trick by the Kushites that they are now going to extend their influence into Egypt. And to make that possible, they are trying to look as Egyptian as possible. So I'm not sure that they are really influenced by Egypt, sort of convinced of the superiority of Egyptian culture. It could just be a scam or a trick. So there's much talk about Pije. That's the son. Pije is the son of Kashta. Kashta is now the king of Kush in this period.
Okay.
And there's a lot of talk in the history books about Pije. I called him Pi as well. There are several names. Pianku. There are several names for this guy.
Right.
But he is generally believed to be a servant of Amun, that he is like super religious for Amun. But I will make the case that this is also just a marketing device on his part, that he's trying to appear Egyptian. And his successor, Taharqa, will be doing a major temple building campaign, also in the name of Amun. P refers to Amun all the time in his writings. We have several writings from P. And he says, you know that Amun is the god who dispatched us, as he sends his army in a swift reaction to events in Egypt in a later episode in the 720s BC. We'll spend a whole episode talking about P. But so we can find that the kings of Kush being buried in Napata, they don't, when they're buried, when they die, they forget all about Amun. They are buried in the Nubian manner, in the Kush manner. So they build pyramids, for example, which nobody has done in Egypt for a long time.
Right.
And it seems that when they die, they forget all about Amun. And even PJ himself will be buried in a Nubian manner.
Wow.
There is also a big question about what PJ did and what his father Kasha did.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
And so if we look at the life of Kashta, we don't have exact years and stuff. He's a very shadowy figure compared to his son. But this is the episode of Kashta, King of Kush. So now we'll have to think about Kashta. It seems to be that rule or the succession in Kush is based on brotherhood. So you give the throne not to your son when you die, but to your brother.
Okay.
Which seems weird, because what happens when you're out of brothers, then it's the son of the last remaining brother. So Kashta had an older brother called Alara, who could be the first king of unified Kush. And already Alara did something involving Egypt, and Kashta is also dealing with Egypt somehow. And in some manner, Kushite influence spreads into Egypt, and it's very unclear when. But Thebes is the biggest city of the south of Egypt, of Upper Egypt. And this city is super ready to accept PJ when he finally invades. So the Thebans seem to already consider PJ their king. So I'm going to make the case that I think that Kashta already took control of southern Egypt.
Okay.
In a very subtle manner. So that Thebes and the surrounding area of southern Egypt is already almost a vassal kingdom to Kush. We know that there was a lot of cultural contact. There was trading. And there is a religious office in Thebes that the Kushite seems to be taking over. And one thing you hear about Kashta is that he actually invaded Egypt. But did he? It's hard to tell.
Was it an invasion, or where was he let in?
Yeah, maybe it was just a great political campaign.
Right.
We know that Kashta is writing his name in cartouches. That is a typical sign of the of an Egyptian pharaoh. He is called, he may have assumed the Egyptian royal title, King of Upper and Lower Egypt, but he obviously had no influence in the north yet.
Right.
Lower Egypt, the north, Upper Egypt, the south, because all they think about is the Nile.
Right.
There is no solid evidence that this is an invasion, that Kashta actually invaded and conquered Thebes, but it could still have happened. There is a fragmentary stele from Aswan bearing Kashta's name, and that's the common evidence to prove that he invaded Egypt. But it could be a later, it could have been constructed several years later. Hmm. So, yeah, it's all very rough here, very, very vague. You can also read about Kashta that he made his daughter the divine adoratrice of Amun. That's the great religious office in Thebes. The divine adoratrice of Amun. So the divine sheikh that worships Amun.
Right.
Pretty much. And that's an important position in Thebes. That's really important. But maybe Kashta did, or maybe not. Or maybe it was Pi who put his sister there. But we will find a daughter of Kashta as the divine adoratress. But in 752 BC, Kashta, the king of Kush, dies. And whatever he did not do, that people says he does, is now done by his son, Pye.
Okay.
So in 752 BC, Pye becomes the king of Kush. And you can sometimes hear the questions, maybe we talked about this, were the Egyptians black?
Mm-hmm.
The Egyptians were obviously Africans.
Right.
But were they black?
I...
Have any thoughts?
Oh, I was going to say, Well, looking at Egyptians today, I'm going to say no.
Yeah, and you're probably correct. And the way one of the pieces of evidence for this mm-hmm. is that when the Egyptians depict Pye, he is utterly black. This guy is from Kush.
Ah.
He's black.
Right.
And there's a great difference in how they portray him.
When they do their paintings and whatnot.
Yes, and this guy is going to appear on paintings in Egypt.
Right.
Because he's going to do stuff. He is going to bring order to Egypt finally.
Hot damn.
It may have been in 747 that he became the king. That's the uncertainty of the dates. Pye is normally counted as the first pharaoh of the 25th dynasty. And to really understand the confusion in Egypt, the 24th dynasty hasn't even started yet.
What?
So we have the 22nd and the 23rd dynasties, and then we have a lot of guys holding supreme power in Egypt, but they don't really call themselves pharaohs. We have two pharaohs of the 22nd and 23rd dynasty. We might have two of the 23rd dynasty at this point, but it's just a mess. But Pye will spend most of his time in Kush dealing with Kush. But when he goes north into Egypt, he will make quite an impression. And we have a full record of what he did in Egypt in 725 BC. So that's why we'll spend a whole episode talking about Pye going into Egypt. Manetho was the Hellenistic historian that created the dynasty system of Egyptian history.
Okay.
And he actually started the 25th dynasty with Shubaka in 713 BC.
Shubaka?
Yeah, Shubaka. We'll talk more about him.
Okay.
But Pye is very hard to ignore. And we will talk about Pye's actions in the narrative and hope that he can restore order to Egypt then. So let's leave Egypt and move to Israel. Israel was having a great time. But in 753 BC, Jeroboam II of Israel dies.
Mm.
And his rule was truly this golden age. And we have archaeological evidence for this. There are large, well-built private houses in Tirsa. That was the old capital of Israel. And there seems to be a very wealthy, privileged class in Israel and much trading going on pretty far abroad. It's been 100 years since the Battle of Karkar in 753 BC. But much of Israel's wealth comes from submitting to the Assyrian Empire when the Assyrian Empire was strong. So after that initial resistance at the Battle of Karkar,
right,
which could be questioned if Israel was even there, but now Israel has become extremely powerful in its local area because they always submit to the Assyrians when they come around, so they don't get destroyed or massacred.
Probably wise.
And then his son picks up the crown. It's Zechariah who becomes the king of Israel in 753 BC. He's the fifth king of Jehu's line. So the line has been going on for five kings. So that's usually a sign of a stable dynasty.
Right.
But Zechariah only rules for 6 months.
Well, that was quick.
Yes, and there ends the dynasty of Jehu. The Jehu's line is snuffed out by a guy called Shallum. In 752 BC, Shallum becomes the king of Israel. This guy seems to have been a captain in the army of King Zechariah. According to the Old Testament, he conspired against Zechariah and smote him before the people.
So he killed him right there in front of everybody?
Yep. And this was a brutal coup then, and Shallum becomes the king of Israel. So now Shallum has this challenge. He has to take over Israel and rule it and make a new dynasty and sort of make the people love him. So will he reign for a long time? What's this guy like? What are his hobbies? What are his visions for Israel? We don't know, because in 752 BC, still the same year, Menahem becomes the king of Israel. I think this is pronounced Menachem.
Menachem?
Really, but I'll try to pronounce it Menachem. He is another officer in Zechariah's army. And when Shalem sees his power, Menachem thinks, oh, I could do that. So he marches his army from Tirsa to Samaria and lays siege to the capital city. And this goes great because Shallum is killed and his reign ends after 1 month.
1 month? Wow.
Yeah, 1 month. Shallum was the king of Israel. And Menachem, he is really scared now because now he is the king of Israel. And he just saw what happened to the last guy. And he has no right to rule Israel except his soldiers. And immediately the city of Tipsa rebels against Menachem. So he decides to deal with this pretty roughly. So instead of waiting for another captain of the army to march on Samaria, Menachem marches on the rebellious city of Tipsa.
Yeah.
And he destroys it in Assyrian fashion. All the inhabitants of Tipsa are killed.
Right.
And he very famously tears open the pregnant women.
Wow.
And kills the unborn babies because of the rebellion.
That's brutal.
This is very much the end of the golden age of Israel, this massacre in Tipsa. Israel is still powerful, but the golden age is now a memory. We have to ask ourselves if this is just biblical slander. We haven't seen... We saw Jehu killing a lot of people in Israel, but this kind of brutal violence is... It's been a while since we saw that. And this city of Tipsa is like... was that really very important? I haven't seen much mentions of it. So it could just be the successors of Menachem trying to tell bad stories about him.
Right.
But we know then that Menachem is a rough, brutal ruler, and he will keep Israel together with violence. But he will run into someone who is more brutal than him.
Oh, no.
Who is a lot more scary than him. That will teach him the time of day. So, after pregnant women getting ripped open, we will do something lighter. We'll have a sports report.
All right,
we've got that let's in the 760.
Exactly. Let's talk about sports. This is bad.
So we have a couple of Olympics to talk about. We'll talk about all the Olympics of the 760s and the 750s BC. So in 768 BC, there is an Olympic Games.
All right.
And we still have only one event. It's that stadium race. They run, then it's over. The whole games last 45 seconds with a day of ceremonies around it. But the race is won in 768 BC by Androcles of Messenia.
Okay.
Messenia is a Dorian nation to the extreme southwest. And Messenia is a powerful Dorian nation. And in the year 764 BC, the fourth Olympic Games is won by Polycarus of Messenia.
Polycarus.
Yes. Polycarus of Messenia, and this guy will reappear in our story. So repeat three times, Polycarus. Yes, the Olympic victor from Messenia, Polycarus. In 760 BC, Elis managed to win the Olympic Games. Aeschines of Elis wins. Elis is this local town very close to Olympia. Mm. And they are the city-state that controlled the Olympic Games.
He didn't have to walk as far.
It's a home team victory.
He wasn't as tired from all the walking.
No. And Messenia doesn't win here for three times in a row. Then, but so the Messenians are disappointed. But the career expectancy of the Olympic winners are very short. So right. Polycarus probably was too old at this point, 4 years later, to compete. In 756 BC, a guy called Oedbatas of Dyme wins the Olympic Games. And Dyme was an ancient Greek city in Achaia to the east.
Okay.
It was the westernmost city of the Achaia, the area of the Achaeans. And the first resident of this city of note was this guy, Oebotas, who was the first Achaean to win the Olympic Games. He received no honors because the Achaeans didn't care for the Olympic Games yet. And he cursed his town because they didn't honor him.
That's a heck of a thing. He knew going in that they didn't care about it.
He thought they would care with this victory, but the Achaeans just didn't care yet. And that's why we have so many Dorians winning the Olympic Games. In 752 BC, we have a change. Something new happens to the Olympic Games. This is the introduction of the crown of leaves.
Oh, okay.
This classic symbol for a victor. It is introduced in 752 BC.
Is it laurels?
Yeah, that's the name. Laurels. Crown of laurels, what do you say?
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's given to Diocles of Messenia. So the Messenians are back, winning the Olympic Games again.
Man.
So you could say that the scene,
go ahead. They are tearing up this competition.
But after 730 BC,
yep,
there will never be a victor from Messenia again, or very few at least. And that's because of the first Messenian War, which we will also spend the whole episode discussing.
Okay.
Because there are some other Dorians that will kick Messenias behind very hard. and probably destroy all their gyms so they can't train for the Olympics.
Oh, yeah, they have no tracks, they have no indoor gyms, no jacuzzis.
Yeah, so Messina will stop winning the Olympics, but right now they are dominating the Olympics. And that's all for this episode.
All right. Well, what is coming up in our next episode, Dan?
It's a great episode. The Greeks will learn to read and write again.
Oh, wow. That'll be interesting.
It will be, I promise you.
I have lots of questions, and we'll find out my questions next time. But please, if you enjoyed it, please go to YouTube, subscribe, like, and share, or give us a review on iTunes. We would love to read them, read your words on this show for anything, any kind of review you give us. We'd like to hear it. So we would like you to also visit, if you can, facebook.com/fanofhistory or thefanofhistory.wordpress.com. If you want to follow me, I'm at Cerulean Says Hi. But if you want to follow Dan, he is at Dan Horning on Twitter. Also, we have a Patreon. Please consider supporting us. Patreon.com/fanofhistory.
Yeah, please do. We are looking for $30 from sponsors. So I feel that's not a huge amount of money. But we need that to go into the 7th century BC. Otherwise, we will find another subject in after the destruction of Sennacherib in 701 BC.
Yeah, so if you want to keep this history train rolling, patreon.com/fanofhistory is the best way of doing that.
Yes.
So, for this week, I am Brennan.
And I'm Dan.
And this has been The Fan of History.
Ooh, yeah.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider supporting us on Patreon, patreon.com/fanofhistory. Just a dollar an episode would help us out. Thanks, and see you next time.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. Warbyparker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.